Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5, I think most of us, when we say Galatians 5, think of the fruits of the Spirit, and that is true. If you look at verse 22 in Galatians 5, it talks about the fruits of the Spirit, and it says, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. And I think most of us have probably heard a sermon on each one of the fruits. You take one, you give a sermon to develop it, to expound it. I would venture to say that there's one fruit that maybe doesn't get as touched on as often as the others, at least in my opinion. And that is the fruit of gentleness. Gentleness. And so I thought that would be a good subject to cover in my next series of sermons in the different congregations where I'm speaking. Many in society look at gentleness more as a weakness. They really don't see it as a strength. And it seems the more that we get more self-centered in our society and people are more interested in their own developments instead of also being willing to look at the developments of others, gentleness sometimes gets lost. It isn't developed in society as much as what it needs to. It may be even in the church at times as much as it needs to. You mentioned looking at gullible, and the response could be, are you serious? Are you really serious? Do you know what happens to gentle people? They get walked over. They get stepped on. They get laughed at. And most often, they're just flat out ignored because they're just so nice and so quote-unquote, gentle. So thanks but no thanks you might get from people in society. Thanks but no thanks. But as we read in Galatians chapter 5, verse 22, we find that gentleness is one of the qualities that God wants to cultivate in our own personal lives. It's part of the fruits of the Spirit. Now, Charles Swindell, I'm sure many of you have heard of Charles Swindell, was quite a lecturer from the past. He writes this, in our rough and rugged individualism, we can think of gentleness as weakness, being soft and virtually spineless. Not so. Gentleness includes such enviable qualities as having strength under control, and I'll discuss that a little bit more a little bit later. Strength under control, being calm and peaceful when surrounded by a heated atmosphere, emitting a soothing effect of those who may be angry or otherwise besides themselves, and possessing tact and gracious courtesy that cause others to retain their self-esteem and their dignity. He says, instead of losing the gentle gain, instead of being ripped off and taken advantage of, they come out ahead. So he's talking about, you know, a calm spirit, being able to emit soothing words and affecting others positively. I'm sure many of you would think of Proverbs where it says, a soft answer does what? Turns away wrath. When you are a peaceful individual and able to speak in a softer manner instead of being belligerent, it can have a positive effect on others in that their anger begins to maybe come down a little bit. But if you don't have that attribute and you come back at them, what happens? The conflict escalates, does it not? That's why Peter says that we should overcome with love, you know, harsh words. Overcome with love, harsh words that may be directed at us. The Greek word for gentleness comes from two words, actually. The first one is proutos. And I'm not even going to try to pronounce it in Greek, but it's spelled P-R-A-U-T-E-S, prautes. The emphasis on the last syllable. The second word is Epikes, E-P-I-E-I-K-E-S. Now, proctus means humility, considerateness, meekness. It usually refers to things, objects, or people. Words that are gentle, soothing, having soothing actions, soothing feelings. The word might refer to tame animals or charitable and generous people. Proctus is something you expect from your friends. You expect people to be gentle with you and kind and soft-spoken. By soft-spoken, I mean they're not angry and belligerent. Now, Epictetus is a word used to express a balanced intelligence, a decent outlook in life, a good citizen, an admired person, a trusted individual. These all fall under the heading of Epictetus. Plato called this the cement of society. Now, the Greeks defined gentleness as power under control, similar to what we just read from Swindell. Power under control. And they have a word picture, the Greeks have a word picture, that is of a horse that had been tamed. You see, gentleness was to them a powerful animal whose passion and power was fully and completely under control. So that's the word picture that the Greeks had for gentleness. A powerful animal, but under control. So, to get a better picture of what this kind of gentleness is all about, I want to use a few examples from Jesus Christ. And use the expression restorative gentleness. Restorative gentleness. I think you'll see that in these examples that I use. Turn over to the fourth chapter of John. John chapter 4. And in the fourth chapter of John, we have Jesus encountering the woman at the well. Okay, he's encountering this woman at the well. Now, this woman was married 5 times, and it was living with a man who wasn't her husband. She's married 5 times, and she's, to use a modern vernacular, she's shacking up with another guy, okay? Living with a man who's not her husband. And on top of that, as all of you I don't know, she was a what? A Samaritan. You might say, among the Jews, she's not the kind of person you want to be associated with. And yet Jesus comes along to this well, and he asks her for a drink of water. And if you read the account, which I'm not going to go through all of it, you'll find that her response wasn't all that kind. Just wasn't all that kind. Yet, Jesus responds, how? Gently. To the Samaritan woman, the Jewish religious leaders would have nothing to do with, let alone the fact that she was married 5 times, living with a guy. But Jesus responds gently. Now, why? Why did he respond gently? Was he afraid of her? Was he afraid someone might see them together? Or worse yet, is he afraid that she may leave and tell people that Jesus spoke to her, sullying his name, this Jew talking to a Samaritan? I think all of us would agree that none of the above would apply. Jesus responded gently because he saw beyond her what? He saw beyond her reputation. He saw beyond her reputation. Jesus saw beyond many people's reputation. And often he didn't condemn, he just gave them encouraging words about, you know, if you change, things will be better for you. So he had an approach that would really cause her to listen. Maybe be able to hear what he had to say. He saw beyond her reputation. He basically saw a thirsty and needy person. He saw a person who really needed living water. Not just the water that we drink to salve our our wetness, our need for wetness. Basically, as I would put it, he saw a person who needed to be restored, and with gentleness, he did just that. As a matter of fact, you'll find, I do want to read just a little bit from this chapter, you'll find that because of his response, she was receptive, began to talk with him and ask him questions, and she... Christ told her what? Said that, I have water that you know not, that you need. You don't even need to come out to this well anymore. Of course, he was speaking spiritually and not physically. So she says, well, give me that water. So he basically set her up to be able to listen and pay attention to her because he was gentle in his approach. Sir, give me this water so I don't get thirsty anymore and have to keep coming out to draw. And... if you look at verse 27, we'll read a little bit here. Verse 26, Jesus declared, I, the one you are speaking to, am he, you know, the Messiah. In verse 27, it says, just then his disciples returned and were surprised to find him talking with a woman. It doesn't say a Samaritan, but it might as well have. Because, just a sidebar here, the Jewish religious leaders wouldn't even talk to their own wives and daughters if they passed them on the street because it was below their dignity. I learned a lot about the life and times of Jesus Christ by teaching the harmony of the Gospels for right at 10 years. Yeah, I did an in-depth study, obviously, because I had to teach it to the kids. And just amazing, a number of things there that I kind of just would look, read over, think I understood. But when you began to look at it in depth, it was amazing. Some of the things that that really were in the scriptures that you just kind of glossed over. But no one asked him, why are you talking to her? But they leave it off. They've been afraid that he would not respond to them gently. I don't know. He may have responded in a way that they would not have liked. I don't think that would be the case. But it says in verse 31 that the disciples urged him to eat something. And once again, he goes directly to the spiritual, right? In verse 32, he says, "But he said, I have food to eat that you know nothing about." He told the woman about the living water. Now he's talking about the food, which is going to basically be his life that he gives and that we partake of on the Passover and all the teachings that he gave. So the disciples, showing that they didn't at this time still understand what he was telling them, then the disciples said to one another, well, could someone have brought him food to eat? They didn't grasp what he was trying to tell them. Now, Christ knew they would grasp it later, right? In verse 35, Jesus said, it is to do the will of him who sent me and to finish his work. In verse 39, dropping on down, many of the Samaritans came from the town believing him because of the woman's testimony. She went back into town, told them all that transpired. And she told them, he told me everything I ever did. So when the Samaritans came to him, they urged him to stay with them, and he stayed 2 days. So not only did he end up impacting this Samaritan woman, but by his conversation, his gentleness, he actually goes into a Samaritan town and spends time with them. And you'll find that in the harmony, the Jewish leaders condemned him for even talking to a woman or talking to a Samaritan. So he stays, and he talks with them. It says many of them believed him. In verse 42, it says, they said to the woman, we no longer believe just because of what you said in telling us about him. Now we have heard for ourselves, and we know that this man really is the Savior of the world. So by his interacting with this woman in gentleness, he had an impact on an entire community. Entire community. Oh, excuse me. Sinuses are draining. Now, John chapter 8, let's take another look at an example of restorative gentleness. Restorative gentleness. Once again, I'm sure all of you are familiar with this woman who was caught in the very act of adultery. And those who caught her were salivating. They were hard, harsh, and judgmental. You could almost feel the soft, smooth stones in her hand getting ready to stone her. But I would say, with Jesus Christ being there, that he didn't pick up a stone. Even though they were asking him what they should do. Let's pick up the story in verse 2 of John 8. At dawn he appeared again in the temple courts where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought a woman caught in adultery. And where was the man? Is a question we could also ask, since she was caught in the act. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. Moses commanded us to stone such a woman. What do you say? And they were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis of accusing him. They weren't gentle at all. But Jesus bent down, started to write on the ground with his finger. And when they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again, he stooped down and he wrote in the ground. And I'm sure all of you maybe have wondered, what did he write, right? What's he writing on the ground here? At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the elder ones first, until only Jesus was left with the woman. So you don't have anyone there left except Jesus and the woman. He wasn't hard. He wasn't harsh. He wasn't just looking for an opportunity to be judgmental. Instead, how does he respond? Jesus straightened up and asked her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" "No one, sir." They all left. And then he says, "Neither do I condemn you." Very gentle answer to her. But he goes on to add, "Go now and leave your life of sin." Or as some translations say, "Go and sin no more." So we find here that once again Jesus saw a person who needed to be restored. And with gentleness, he restored her. I wonder what her life was like after this encounter. To me, in my heart of hearts, I would think it impacted her in a very positive way. And she changed the lifestyle that she had. Can I prove it? No, I can't. But I wouldn't believe it. And all because of how Jesus dealt with her. Fulfilling, again, one of the fruits of the Spirit, gentleness. Gentleness can have a powerful effect on people as opposed to the opposite. How about Luke chapter 19? Let's look at another example. Again, this is a story about a wee little man that we all know as Zacchaeus, right? Jesus was coming along and he wanted to see, but he was so short he couldn't see over anybody. He'd almost have to stoop down and look between their legs. And so instead of doing that, he does what? Let me remember the story. What did he do? Yeah, he climbed up in a tree. He's got a good look at this Jesus who was coming. Now Zacchaeus was a hated tax collector. He was rich because he took money from other people. And whenever they had a tax that they had to pay, he would add to that and keep the difference. And he was despised by everyone. Now, what does Jesus do upon seeing Zacchaeus? Point his finger at him and accuse him of being a thief, which he really was? No. You find that Jesus looks up, points him, and says, "Zacchaeus, come down from that tree. I'm coming to your house for dinner tonight. I would say that Jesus saw beyond Zacchaeus' right reputation. He saw a man who was in need of being restored. And as we read the story, think about it, because you'll see that Jesus restored him with gentleness. Let's read that story in Luke 19, verse 19. It says, Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. And a man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief, not just a tax collector, but a chief tax collector. It was meant he had tax collectors underneath him. And he was very wealthy. And he wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he could not see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him. It says Jesus was coming his way. And with the story again, which I've related to you, when Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and says, Zacchaeus, come down. I must stay with you tonight. So he came down once and welcomed him gladly. Now, what was the response of the people? Same as with the woman at the well. Same as with the woman caught in adultery. All the people saw, verse 7, and began to mutter, he's gone to be the guest of a sinner. But notice what Zacchaeus says. And remember, Zacchaeus was a thief because he took beyond what was required. He probably got a cut out of all the other tax collectors who would, you know, who worked under him. And Barclay brings out that after his encounter with Jesus Christ, not before, this is what he basically says. He stood up and said to Jesus, Lord, Lord, here and now, as of now, I will give half of my possessions to the poor. Before that, he was taxing the poor as much as he could. I will give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I cheat anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times that amount. That wasn't what he did before meeting Jesus Christ. I don't know the conversation that they had when they were having dinner, but it was enough to impact Zacchaeus' life. Zacchaeus was restored because of Jesus Christ's gentleness. That was part of, shall we say, the tools that Jesus Christ used. The Christ says, today, salvation has come to the house, to this house. Number one, Jesus was there. And also because of Zacchaeus' new approach to life. There's been a conversion, so to speak. Maybe not in the spiritual sense of receiving God's Holy Spirit. I don't know if Zacchaeus happened to be one of the, you know, people who became converted there in Acts chapter 2. It doesn't tell you, but obviously some did. And then Jesus says in verse 10, for the Son of Man came to seek and to save the lost. And gentleness, a gentle spirit, is what can be used to help impact people in a positive way as opposed to the other spirit. Let's look at the last one, last example. Luke chapter 10. This is at the home of Martha and Mary. Again, we all know the story, right? Jesus comes to the home, and what's Martha doing? She's doing the same thing that many wives do when they have guests. My wife is exactly like this. House has to be spick and span. She's out there, you know, cooking, da 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 da. You try to get her to calm down because she's German. She doesn't. You know, she's a go. And verse 38 of Luke. Chapter 10. Try to picture this scene of Martha, a friend of Jesus who invited him and his disciples over for dinner. Excuse me. Obviously, there was lots of preparation needed to go into this meal. She was serving Christ and disciples. Verse 38, Luke 10. Jesus and his disciples were on their way. He came to the village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. And I would think as time progressed, Martha's wondering, where's my help? You know, maybe pans began to be banged a little bit so that individuals would hear what she's doing. And maybe, oh, maybe we should go help Martha. Bang, 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 bang. Especially Mary, her sister, right? So she was distracted. And so finally, after a period of time, she came to him and asked, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Now, I don't know if she went to her sister first. Did she go to Mary and say, Mary, I need some help. Mary, just ignore her? Or did she just make a beeline to Jesus Christ and say, aren't you concerned that my sister sitting over here isn't helping me? Now, he could have responded in a negative way. Martha said, tell her to help me. Tell her to get off her, you know what? Get in here and help me with this dinner. And Jesus says, you can almost hear the gentleness come, Martha, Martha. Not correcting her. Martha, Martha, you are worried and upset about many things. But few things are needed, or indeed only one. And Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. I don't read anywhere else in any of the Harmony Gospels, unless I've missed it, where it gives us Martha's response to Jesus Christ's gentleness. Maybe Martha said, you know, you're right. She went and sat down next to Mary. I don't know. I'm just saying, look at what transpired here. Martha was getting all worked up, stands in front of Jesus. I can almost see her with her hands on her hips saying, tell Mary to get in here and help me. Instead, he speaks to her gently. When you use the name twice, according to Barclay, when you use a person's name twice, it carries the tone of endearment. Okay? Carries the tone of endearment. He didn't use harsh words. Jesus saw what? He saw beyond her anger. He saw beyond her jealousy. He saw a woman who needed to be restored, and he restored her in gentleness. So again, Jesus gives us a very fine example of how to deal with people. Again, going back to a soft answer, turns away wrath. What does the other half of that verse say? But harsh words what? Stir up anger, stir up strife. I think I used the example of my wife. The example I used about my wife, one of my marriage workshops, using this same principle, soft answer. And I said, how do you think Sonia would respond, especially those of you who know Sonia, how do you think Sonia would respond if I came in from the garage into the kitchen and I could just see in her face she's upset and angry. You know, she's slamming chairs up against the table, slamming the cabinet doors. What would happen if I walked up and said, Sonia, what's wrong with you now? How do you think that would go over? Not very well. But if I walked in with what Jesus had talked about, I said, Sonia, Sonia, I can see you're upset. Obviously, something's bothering you. I don't know what it is, but I'm here and I'm willing to sit down and talk with you about it. If there's anything I can do to help. A soft answer has a way of, like it says, bringing down the anger. Jesus Christ knew that. That's why patience is one of the fruits of God's Holy Spirit. Now, you might say, well, yeah, but that's Jesus. He was all-powerful. He was the Son of God. If I live like that, I might get stomped on. You might, because there might be some people out there who would stomp on you no matter who you are. But, you know, from a worldly perspective, Jesus did get stomped on. right? From a worldly perspective, yet he always had the same approach. Judas did what? Betrayed him. Peter did what? Peter denied him. One of his quote-unquote best friends. How about the other friends? They all deserted him. Either they're in the Garden of Gethsemane. Sounds like he was getting stomped on to me by people. But before all of the betrayal, and when Jesus was about to die, when he was in the garden, he knew what was coming. How did he have the strength to do what he did? To live his life for 33 and a half years without sin. To go through what he was going to face. Oh, but that's Jesus. Well, trust me, he was tempted in all manners as any man or woman. He had to draw strength from somewhere. And we all know he drew that from his Father. Now, how many here have seen the picture of Jesus Christ in the garden at the time of his crucifixion? Anybody see that picture? It's a painting. There are many copies made. You know it's old. He's in the garden. He's kneeling before a big rock. His hands are folded, and he has a serene look on his face. And there's a light coming down from heaven. Anybody remember seeing that picture, though? Yeah, a couple of you. Yet that's not the way it was. That wasn't how it happened. They would like you to think that, or maybe they wanted to sell a bunch of pictures or painting. That's not what happened. Turn over to Matthew 26. Matthew 26. Where did this power come from? Same place we need to get power when we need to be gentle, patient. Well, it's not an easy time to be just that. 36. Matthew 26, verse 36. Let's see about Jesus' prayer in Gethsemane. Because Jesus talks about his soul being overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death. Matthew 26, 36. Jesus went with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to his disciples, "Sit here while I go over there and pray." And talking with him, Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, he began to be sorrowful and troubled. There's not a real serene picture here. Sorrowful and he was troubled. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." And going a little farther, he fell on his face and he prayed, saying, "My Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will be done." He does that, you know, put all the harmonies together about three different times, and finally after the third time, he says, "It's enough." That's a good question to ask. What did Jesus mean, "It is enough"? You might ponder that. He went three times, finally says, "It is enough," and he knows he has to leave and go down and face his enemies. So they leave he leaves from his prayer, verse 51. He's down there now, they've come to get him. And as they go to arrest him, verse 51 says, "Behold, one of those who were with Jesus struck out his hand, drew a sword, and struck the servant of the high priest and cut off his ear." Don't you have to envision this soldier grabbing his ear, you know, maybe falling on the ground and blood squirting out everywhere. But Jesus says, it was Peter, by the way, who did this, "Put your sword back into its place, for all who take the sword will perish or die by the sword." Verse 53 is very interesting. He says, "Do you not think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels." I pondered that. What was going on here? I mean, Christ says, don't you know that? And I'm guessing the fact that he's saying it would have happened, right? That would not have been good for us. Verse 44, but Jesus says, but how then should the scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so? So Jesus was filled with anguish, very sorrowful, even unto death. And he goes before the Father, and if you put all the harmony accounts together, this it says he went three times. I wasn't going to tell you, but I'll tell you my opinion. Just that, I can't prove it. My opinion. But Christ went three different times to deal and pray about the same subject. The last time he gets up and says, it is enough. Now I think about Paul, who said, God, how many times for his thorn in the flesh? Three times. The guy basically tells him, Paul, it's enough. You know, this is the situation. I personally think that after the third time of Christ praying diligently, he always had the Father with him. He had never sinned, but he talked to the Father, you know, very sincerely, heartfelt, to the point of dropping great drops of blood, of sweat. And after the third time, he said, it's enough. I don't need any more, you know. My strength is fully with me to face this trial. And he went down and he dealt with it. He didn't give away his patience. He actually healed the guy who had his ear struck off. I would say that Jesus Christ had power and strength under control. Power and strength under control because he knew who was in control. And that was the Father who was giving him the strength and that was necessary. Turn over to Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. So what does the fruit of gentleness look like in your life? What does it look like in my life, in our relationships? How does it look like in our church, our local small congregation? It means that there are going to be times that Frank McCready is not going to get his way. Just not going to get his way. I have to accept that fact that it's going to happen. Have you always gotten your way every single time because you could out-scream or out-holler or out-bully the other person, your brother, your sister, your husband, your wife? I know it's hard for us sometimes, including me, to accept that fact, that's going to happen. It means I'm going to have to do all I can, and then I'm just going to have to let go and trust God. Let go and let God sometimes is what's necessary. Let go and let God. There are going to be times when I have to give up my right to be right. And any time I think about that particular statement, it reminds me of a man in Dayton, Ohio, where I pastored. He didn't attend our congregation regularly, but he came in and visited often from the congregation to our north up in that Elkhart, Indiana area. He'd come down to Fort Wayne, where I pastored. I'm sorry. He'd come down from, what's that town just north of Dayton where we have a congregation? Youngstown, Ohio. He'd come down and visit. He had family in the area, and he would attend church with us. And he was very opinionated. And he was one who always had to be right, and he always had to be right on one particular subject. What do you think that subject was? Prophecy. He had his own ideas, his own concepts. He had all the charts like we all used to have. Remember those charts we used to have way back when? And he just had to be right. And he got into a conversation with me about a particular subject, which differed a little bit from our church's position, which we always say is speculative, but this is how we feel. And so I tried to explain to him our position, how we felt about it. He would say, no, that's just not right. This is how it is. So I tried from a different angle. No, that is just not right. This is how it is. And as I noticed his voice begin to get a little bit louder, not yelling or screaming, but a little bit more forceful, like he had to get louder to get his point across, I said, well, Harry is not his name, by the way. I said, you know what? Prophecy, a lot of it is speculative as far as the timing of what takes place. I tell you what, why don't you and I just lay the subject aside and, you know, when Jesus Christ returns or certain things happen at that particular time, then we'll know. And if you're right, I'd be more than happy to accept that. I didn't add to that, but if I'm right, would you accept it? I just left that part go. When I took that approach of not wanting to fight with them, but just try to come up with a peaceful, a gentle way to approach it, he dropped the subject. He said, yeah, he said, okay, I agree. Sometimes you just have to give up your right to be right, to let it go. Philippians 2, beginning in verse 4, it says, let each of you not only look to your own interest. I'm going to pause there. Because we all do need to look to our own interest. We all do need to take care of our families. Husband needs to help take care of the wife. Wife needs to help take care of the husband, take care of the kids. Go through all the ramifications of your interest. Maybe a hobby that you... Nothing wrong with that. But, it says, don't just look out for your own interest, but also to the interest of others. You have to be willing to look out for the interest of others. In other words, your attitude should be the same of that as that of Jesus Christ. And what do we know about his attitude? Well, he took the very nature of a servant. He humbled himself even to the point of death that we all might be saved. Excuse me. Don't speak anything to bother me. Which means I should probably just shut up. So if we think about it, each of us living to serve one another, to love one another, to put other interests, maybe sometimes above our own for their well-being and our own well-being as well. It's an attitude that prompts us to park a little farther away so that others, if we're going to a dinner, might have a closer spot to park. Just a thought. I don't even think about it from that perspective. I just look for a parking spot and park. Ironically enough, my wife and I went out with our son Michael and Odette last week. We went to the steakhouse. What's it called? Lone Star Steakhouse or something like that. Roadhouse. It was Roadhouse. And there wasn't a spot to park. We had to actually park in the next door shopping center and walk over. Of course, we were concerned about if it's that busy, are we going to be able to get in? We only ended up having about a 15-minute wait. So in that case, I didn't have to park someplace else and let somebody else have that spot. They already had it. Maybe we would donate some food to a food pantry a little more often, putting other needs ahead of ours, and admitting sometimes, well, maybe I am wrong. I don't think I am, but maybe I am, because this person has pointed everything out. You're willing to accept that as a possibility instead of demanding what? Your rights. We stay close to the vine. Jesus Christ, whether he was washing feet, serving lunch, he had a lot of guests for lunch, healing the sick, standing before Pilate, Jesus knew he was the Son of God, sent to serve and sent to restore. No matter what his circumstance, he was sent to serve and sent to restore. So gentleness is displayed in our behavior in many different ways. One, with our language. With our language. Guarding our words. Ephesians 4:29. Gentleness explained here. So if we're going to be a gentle person, we have to guard our speech first and foremost. We must realize that our words can shape lives, mend broken hearts, and inspire hope to our wife, to our husband, to our children. As followers of Jesus Christ, we must guard our words with kindness. And sometimes we have to speak the truth. It doesn't mean you lie or don't face issues that you may need to, but even when you face the truth, how do you reface it? What's the Bible say? You speak the truth how? In love. And my wife has said more than once, the more truth you speak, the more love you need. You know? When husbands and wives sit down to discuss something that's come up with different, maybe a disagreement, or things being seen differently, or something, there's been a hurt, and you know you're going to have to speak the truth, you can speak it from the perspective of, I'm right, you're wrong, this is what you need to do to change. Or you can speak the truth from the standpoint of, you know, right, this is how I feel. And then the other person explains how he or she feels. You're speaking your truth because both of you see that truth differently. I'll guarantee you when there's a conflict. But how you do it is important. You speak that truth in love, where the other person knows that there's great concern and great positive feelings for the other mate. Speaking the truth in love. It has a powerful impact on our family relationship. 429, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth. Ephesians 4:29, don't let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth, but only what helps build up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. So if you're talking, trying to help somebody, and you want it to benefit them, you've got to do it with wholesome words, with an attitude of gentleness. Only what helps build up others according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. So again, this verse is a general reminder that our words should be a source of encouragement, edification, and healing. Restorative gentleness, the phrase they use and show through Jesus Christ's example. I got this from Barclay. To cultivate kindness in our speech, we must be mindful of our chosen words and their effect on others. Let us strive to speak words of affirmation. Excuse me. Words of affirmation, love, encouragement. Let us actively listen to others, seeking to understand their needs, and responding with empathy. And let us humbly apologize and seek forgiveness when our words have harmed others. By guarding our words with kindness, we can reflect Christ's gentle and compassionate heart in our interaction with others. A gentle person has the ability to do this. Then we have the next step. We have our words under control. We then have to show this gentleness, demonstrating it with compassionate actions. Compassionate actions. See, kindness is not limited to words alone. It should also be evident in our actions toward others. Our compassionate actions provide tangible expressions of Christ's love and care in a world desperately needing kindness. That's from one of our booklets. Unfortunately, I can't remember which one I got it from. Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4. Verse 32. Paul instructs us to be kind and compassionate to one another. Notice. Well, we read that earlier, so we won't read it again. It goes beyond mere sentiment or feelings. It goes into the fact of actions being required. We actually engage in acts of kindness and compassion toward those around us. What kind of actions could a person use after he talks kindly to somebody in need? Not a hard question. You do what you can to help what? Fulfill that need. What can I do to help? I've given him all these nice words, but what can I do to actually help him? I don't have this in my notes, but it kind of reminds me of the statement about faith. You can talk about faith all you want, but if you don't demonstrate it, what good is it? That's James. James says, let me demonstrate my faith by my what? By my works. All it says is, let me demonstrate my faith by what I do. So we have not many members in our congregation, but we have some. What do we have? How many members do we actually have here? As far as members, obviously not everybody comes to church every week, but some are sick, some are out of town. How many do we have? Just 20? So it's not a huge number compared to what we used to have, but there's still 20 people here, and I'm sure there are needs that one or the other might need, and if we are able, sometimes we just can't because of our own situation, old health or whatever, but if we're able, not only giving them a phone call, which would be very good to do, expressing your concern, doing what we can to help when we are able to do that. Seeking opportunities, in other words, to demonstrate compassionate actions instead of just verbiage. In the second half of verse 32, I'd say which we read earlier of Ephesians, Paul encourages us to forgive each other just as Christ has forgiven us. You'll find a person who's not very gentle, it is kind of hard, has a hard time with forgiving. They have a tendency to be more judgmental. Classic example, again, your religious leaders during Christ's age. They were not compassionate men, to say the least. They were very hard. They were unforgiving. They were very judgmental. That is the opposite of the fruits of the Spirit. We're to express the same attitude and spirit of Christ. And when we do that, we become conduits of His love, forgiving as we've been forgiven, and extending grace to those who may not at times even deserve it. Now, let me begin to wrap this up with just a couple of other examples of Jesus Christ, and I have some questions for you. I think of Matthew 23, verse 37, when I think of Jesus Christ's gentleness, even when he had to deal and correct some of the religious leaders of his day, which he had to do. Woe unto you, woe unto you, woe unto you. But you get down to verse 37, after he goes through correcting them, he says, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. He was willing to show compassion and mercy even to some of the hardest religious leaders, but they wouldn't have it. See, you can be patient, merciful, kind to people, but there are going to be some who are just obstinate. They don't like you. They don't care what you do or what you say. They're just not going to like you. You know what? You done your part, you walk away, he doesn't like me, that's fine. I will what? Pray for him. And by the way, the word pray is P-R-A-Y. It's not P-R-E-Y. It's not where I'm going to pray on him. Matthew 11:29. Christ said, take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am what? I am gentle. Matthew 11, verse 29. I am gentle and lowly in heart. And if you do that, you will find rest for your soul. A gentle person finds rest. He's not beleaguered by all that's taking place around him. So we find that Jesus Christ makes a connection between gentleness and humility. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 1. Now I, Paul, myself, am pleading with you by the meekness and the gentleness of Christ. Again, we see Paul including the words meekness and lowliness in conjunction with gentleness. And then Philippians chapter 4, verse 5. Philippians 4. Philippians 4, verse 5, tells us this: let your gentleness be known to all men. The Lord is at hand. Now, you might ask this question: why does God want those he is working with to be concerned with how they are, how they think, act, and talk? It's a very simple answer. Jesus Christ has all the power of the universe. And one day he's going to do what? He's going to share that power with us. Harmony tells us that using the example that you might reign over 5 cities, 10 cities, because none of you here is going to bury your talent, right? And when he gives you that power, he knows that we will not use it cruelly or rashly. When you've developed the very nature, the spiritual fruits, God knows that when he gives you that power, you're going to demonstrate that power through restorative gentleness. So let me ask you a few questions as we conclude. If you're not sure whether you're growing in gentleness, ask these questions. Number one, am I easily angered? Am I easily angered? Number two, do I hold on to grudges? Oh, I've got a relative that just won't let go. Not in the church, by the way, but she is just, you do something wrong, she'll never forget it. Number three, do I speak harshly to others? Do I speak harshly to others? And do I react rationally in situations? So again, am I easily angered? Do I hold on to grudges? Do I speak harshly to others? And do I react rationally in situations? I would say this, that if you answer yes to any of these questions, you might need to work on becoming more gentle. Gentleness helps you deal with these four questions. So even though it might be one of the lesser fruits, when I say lesser, I mean talked about the least. It's definitely not lesser, but talked about the least. It's still a very important attribute that we should develop in our own personal lives to become more like our Father and our brother, Jesus Christ.